Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman. In collaboration with the United Nations Food System Summit, we've launched an 8-part miniseries called Laying Down Tracks. It's a talk show to discuss the impact of food and its production on the human condition around the globe. Thus far, it's been pretty well received. In fact, we've decided to extend the playlist a bit here, and we've decided to add a few encore episodes to focus on stories that, well, need to be heard. Stories to be heard by a growing number of folks out there who have awoken to the notion that food may just be our best mechanism to stabilize an uncertain planet. Today, for our episode, we are dedicating it to food solutions for the forcibly displaced. Although the exact number is effectively impossible to know, the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, the UNHCR, frequently known as the UN's Refugee Agency, estimates that as of 2020, global forced displaced has surpassed 80 million people. That's a number which has skyrocketed in the past decade. Joining me to shed some light on who the forcibly displaced really represent and why we're seeing such an increase in numbers is the Assistant High Commissioner of Operations at the UNHCR, Ralph Mazou. Ralph, how are you doing today? Thanks for joining.
Thank you very much, Aaron, for having me, and very pleased to join you on this podcast.
So, Ralph, let's start with that initial question. So, who does the forcibly displaced represent, and why such a precipitous increase of displaced people?
Who they represent? They represent everybody, and on all continents around the world, you have forcibly displaced people, whether they are internally displaced in their country or whether they've crossed the border into neighboring countries. Throughout the world, we have people who are forcibly displaced. What are the trends? Unfortunately, we've seen a drastic increase in the number of people who are forced to leave their homes. I would say the COVID-19 pandemic has actually accelerated that movement. Why do they leave their home? Mostly because of insecurity, because of violence, because of the effect of climate change also. We see that, but even that effect of climate change is often resulting in conflict for resources. And that is why people are moving. So that's what the picture is. It's not a good picture. It's unfortunately a picture that sees the situation deteriorating. One point to add, you have a link between displacement and food insecurity. People leave their home because of food insecurity, and the fact that they've left their home results in more food insecurity because they cannot produce anymore their food.
It is not a good thing. It's not a good number. It's scary stuff, but someone's going to be there to help pick up all these pieces. And in your agency, the UNHCR does this. So how do you deal with getting this group the required humanitarian relief and aid?
We work first, and Valerie is here. So clearly, a very important partner of ours is WFP. I think last year, in 2019, we provided food for about 10 million refugees around the world. So we partner with WFP when it comes to food, but there are all the other sectors of assistance, whether it is health, whether it is education, whether it is water and sanitation. And for that, we work with governments, which are the ones providing asylum, people who are the ones providing asylum and receiving people, and also a number of partners around the world to make sure that the assistance that is needed at the beginning of a displacement, the emergency assistance that is needed is provided. One thing which I'm sure we'll discuss more, it's the fact that initially we do provide humanitarian assistance, we do provide emergency assistance, but in the long run, what we need to try and do is to make sure that people can, as early, as fast as possible, start becoming self-reliant. And that's a big, big challenge that we're having now. And we are trying to find solutions to this challenge.
Yeah, I would imagine that that's part of the infrastructure that you put in there is that self-reliance. But I would guess that also for those fleeing any of that oppression from a hostile dictator or persecution or genocide or drought or floodwater, for whatever reason they are becoming forcibly displaced, people will push themselves to their boundaries. But eventually we do need, as you mentioned, Ralph, food to eat and water to drink. And as you mentioned, the branch of the United Nations responsible for this food assistance is the World Food Program. Joining this Encore episode to share some insights on what's required to deliver nutritious food to these displaced people around the world is the Assistant Executive Director of the WFP, Valerie Newsom-Guarnari. Hey, Valerie, how are you doing today?
Hi, Aaron. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining. It's such a pleasure. I was reading a bit about your backgrounds and your efforts. Just amazing stuff. And, I'd say a good meal for folks who have not seen one for days or weeks seems essential. But for the WFE, it's more than that, isn't it? This is about sustained efforts for longer-term solutions in their new host countries. So can you tell our listening audience a bit about how the WFP tackles these challenges?
Well, hunger, conflict, displacement, these are all so carefully intertwined. And we find that there's growing hunger in the world, there's growing displacement leading to that hunger. And people move when they're scared or when they're unable to meet the needs of their family. And food is just such a basic need. We need our food. We need it, three times a day, preferably. Families spend up to 80% of their income and in stressful situations on food, and it's a constant requirement for all of us. And so we partner very closely with UNHCR at the World Food Program, and our effort is really to be their go-to partner in ensuring that people who are displaced, people who are fleeing their country, get the food that they need, nutritious food on a daily basis to support them, and as soon as possible to help people be able to feed themselves.
You both are mentioning the self-reliance. I think it's a key part to bring up, and maybe if you could give us an example, Valerie, of a scenario anywhere in the world. Take us to anywhere in the world where UNHCR and WFP have worked together and seen some successes where you were able to stabilize situations with the refugee camp or settlement, or and then taught that infrastructure around self-reliance. Is there any anecdotes that you can share to help us ground this?
There are many different ways in which we meet people's food needs. And the most basic way is bringing food and distributing it on a monthly basis, usually, to people who are caught up in conflict and people who are living in refugee camps. And we have, decades of experience doing that. But over the past decade, we've also broadened out our toolbox to be able to be providing cash when the main and the best way to ensure access to food is through the market. So in situations where food is available, but just not accessible to people, providing them with cash in order to do that. And last year, WFP provided $2.1 billion in cash transfers. And refugees are a big part of that. When we provide cash to refugees in close coordination with UNHCR, then that gives those refugees the chance to meet their own food needs through the market. That's a win-win situation for the refugees and for the host population. It provides income and demonstrates the contribution that the refugees make to the local economy. And it also gives the refugees themselves the opportunity to choose the foods that they are purchasing, the opportunity to buy more fresh and more nutritious foods that help meet their needs better, provide better nutrition for their children and for their families. And there's an opportunity to link even with local farming systems and local food systems in the area. So providing cash to refugees is one of the ways in which we've helped build their self-reliance, but also the dignity of the assistance provided. But we also have had opportunities working with UNHCR to help people engage in small-scale agricultural production. A big problem for a lot of refugees is access to land. They may not have access to enough land to grow the food that they and their families need. But sometimes they have access to some land. And so one really exciting solution that we've been working on that actually came from our engagement with refugees, Sahrawi refugees in Algeria, is by adapting a low-tech hydroponics techniques that allow for people to grow food in impossible places. And we've now branched out to take that technology beyond the Sahrawi context into supporting, for example, Somali refugees in Djibouti and enabling them to grow food to address their needs. So wherever there's an opportunity, even with a little bit of land, to support refugees to grow at least some of their food needs, and then in context where refugees aren't in a camp situation, but are in a community situation, like for instance in Uganda, we take the opportunity to support them to grow more. So a variety of ways in which we can help refugees to be more self-reliant.
Just amazing work. And that makes such sense around the cash, the ripple effect of the local dollar spent, right? Because I remember even in discussions where I come from in the Northeast United States, the discussions where the local dollar spent has a 5x ripple effect. I can imagine it's similar for local communities. And what a way to ingratiate yourself, immerse yourself into that when you're buying goods and services and being part of the local economic system to support other infrastructure. So I'm sure it's mutually beneficial when you get those results. Okay, let's find out more. So joining us, our guest in this special encore episode of Laying Down Tracks, is Malish James. Hey, Malish, how are you doing today?
Yes, Amara.
So thanks for calling. You're calling in to us from Uganda, is that correct?
I am a South Sudanese, a refugee in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
I came in Uganda in 2016. That was following the conflict that happened in South Sudan in between the political leaders. I think what forced most of the refugees from South Sudan to Uganda, it is that war. And as a result of that war, it brought a lot of food insecurity, where most of people were not able to access for them food, and that forced them to go. The war was now escalating in some areas, but some areas were not yet affected with the conflict, but others were now affected with food insecurity, because the channels to the going channels from the from other countries to the site where they are, the food channel was already cut, and the way people were surviving, they were cultivating for themselves their own food. It was now hard since there was now a rebel in the bush and government at the other side, because people used to go in a distance from where they had to cultivate. And it was now a bit challenging for someone to go far from where he is. You find your life is always restricted. Then most of the people were now getting, children were getting malnourished. So there was no way to stay. They had to flee to Uganda. So like me personally, in 2016, I was in Juba, the city of South Sudan,
mm-hmm.
where the conflict got me within the city. It started like just in a funny way, where I was on motorcycle riding. I came in between soldiers. That's when the vice president, and the president was the vice president, who is now first vice president. He was a rebel. They were having a meeting inside the state house. So when I was passing by, I got soldiers standing at the other side of the road, and the other side of the road, the same road like this. At the other side, it was for the vice president, and the other one was for the president. So I moved like twice. Then secondly, the way they stood, it was now scary. And secondly, as I want to pass by there, then I was stopped to go back. Then I just, on my motorcycle, as I was going, before I reached home, I had some gunshot behind. That was the starting of the war. The soldiers who stood by the roadside started shooting themselves face to face, and most of them died right there. And that's when the vice president was now forced to come out from the city. He now entered the bush, and the rebellion starts, and the war continued going on. So as we're now in the city, after the war, it was really terrible. You can find some families. You stay inside your home because it was really insecure for someone to move from his home to another center, because the shops were closed, the markets were closed. So people were starving inside. There was no food, no way you can access for yourself food. So that thing really forced me. I feel my life was not safe anymore. Mm. I got the chance of now coming out of South Sudan. As we are coming on the way from Juba to Uganda, we passed by, we got dead soldiers on the way, and civilians, those who are shot on crossfire. We just got dead bodies by the roadside, the abandoned cars of the soldiers with some fully armed was burned. So passing from Juba to Uganda was really scary as we are moving. We moved and we crossed the border, and I felt peace in my heart as I crossed the border of South Sudan and Uganda. As I stepped in Uganda, I felt relieved, because I was now feeling myself in a safer place. People were moving normal. They were welcoming, and we were also welcomed by the UN agencies, which is WFP and the UNHCR itself. They welcomed us and put us in a fence. We were given ready cooked food and some biscuits. So there, I felt people already safe. Then we are now taken from the reception at the border. Now we dropped here in BDB, the refugee settlement. Though we are dropped in the bush, there was no home, no house, but we felt we are safe because we have left a terrible situation where we are undergoing in Juba. So here we started new life. We started constructing some shelter for us by the help of UNHCR and other agencies on the ground, like IRC and Red Cross. Others were able to come in, intervene to help the refugees. So we started new life. So by then we are receiving like 14 kgs of food per month, but reaching some extents, since WFP was also running out of funding, the food was able to be deducted little by bit by bit. As I'm talking for now, it is now 7.5 from that 14. We are getting 7.5 per month. And most challenging thing is that 7.5 for now, it can't take people up to the end of the month. And that makes some other families to sleep hungry. But however, the land given in the camp is like 30 by 30. So you have to put some little house in it, and you have to cultivate in it. So it's not enough that someone can get enough food for himself. And although it was also, they gave some land outside the camp in the host community site, but unfortunately this year, most of the host community members have taken back their land, because it's like now also costing for them some in food security. Food insecurity. So they were able to, they have taken back their land. They are cultivating it. Most of the refugees have nowhere to go and cultivate, and they have no access to get another support from somewhere. So the situation on ground, it's a bit challenging, because I felt I have seen some families running out of food before time.
you know, one of the things that I think we're focused on here are some of these self-reliant solutions. Valerie had mentioned the infrastructure around hydroponics being put in certain spots. Are you seeing in the Bitty Bitty settlement a opportunity? Are you seeing people come together to find new solutions to become more self-reliant? Are you seeing any kind of progress in that space?
Yeah, there's some progress around. Yeah, there are some communities who are coming together and with the help of some agencies to solve the cases to at least secure their life and maybe create some group to cultivate and to fight in food insecurity. This is right. It's there on ground, but they just need to be empowered. There's need for more empowerment for refugees here and the settlement.
And Valerie and Ralph, I'll encourage you to join in with any questions that you have for Malish or for each other. And that would be a you're more than welcome at any point to jump in. I had another quick question from Malish tied to that. Malish, so you have, there's what I read, 270,000 people in the settlement, and there's 1.4 million refugees in Uganda. It's about the population of Munich, Germany. Have you found that breaking bread with others allows you to find some common ground and have some of these discussions? So sitting down for a meal, or even maybe growing that meal, allows you to find some common ground and work together on some of these solutions.
Yeah, yes. I was talking of progress. Yeah, I've seen some progress that people are trying to take, and mostly they are young people on ground that are able to do some other thing for themselves to at least be self-reliant. And more especially, there are some agricultural groups that are able to do for them some farming and with the help of some agencies, as I said. And what is needed for them is mostly they are lacking some skills. So most of the people, they just need to be empowered with some skills so that they can be self-reliant. And more especially the young people, and most of them need still education. There are some who have gone to school, but to some extent they are unable. And this situation has made them to now have some families. I think they need some vocational trainings. This is what is really needed on the ground so that they can have some skills to fight food insecurity and to make them be self-reliant.
Yes, no, Malish, thank you very much for the point that you raised. One question that I have for you is the issue of the relationship with the host community. Uganda is one of the countries in the world which has been the most welcoming when it comes to receiving refugees, and as you said yourself, giving land, even if it's small land, to refugees. But with COVID, with the economic crisis that we see everywhere, you made reference to the fact that some of the land that had been given by the host, they've taken it back because they needed it. How what's the relationship now with the host community, and what do you think needs to be done to make sure that the relationship continues to be positive, if it is positive?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that question. Yeah, the relationship right now between refugees and the host community around, it's not seriously alarming. What refugees just realized is because these people have right to own their land, because if someone helped you to give you something, at least to work on it and take it back, they don't take it serious, and it doesn't cause conflict because they know the land belongs to them. And as they have taken it back, I think refugees are just calm. They didn't even take action seriously. They are trying to harmonize the situation. With the COVID-19 situation right now, it is actually challenging down here. As I'm talking right now, Uganda is also under serious lockdown. It was given like 42 days lockdown to come. I think people really face it rough because it is challenging. Those who are trying to do some little business, they are unable to go far in some cities to get for themselves some food materials so that they come and sell all their business materials. It's a bit hard. So I think transports are stopped, everything has been stopped. So it's a bit challenging, but the life with the host community is not among refugees and host community is not seriously alarming. It is just normal because most of the refugees already knew how conflict affect people. Now, if they raise and like talk much to the host community, maybe the host communities might raise against it and it will be so bad. I think they have just calmed down and they didn't do anything about that. And you said Uganda is a very good country that I've ever seen. It has become second home for me as myself. This is not my first time to be a refugee. I have been a refugee some years, but since when I was young with my family, my parents were taken in Congo. From Congo, we crossed to Uganda. That was early 2000s. I was also here in Uganda. Uganda has been welcoming, or it has been a welcoming country for refugees. So it allows refugees to move freely within this country, within Uganda. So it's not like other countries that refugees are kept in a fence or under tight security. Uganda is not like that. I think the relationship with Uganda is just, it's normal. There's no much problem with that.
What more do you think, because now with this situation of the host taking back their land, what additional support would you expect from the World Food Programme, from UNHCR to deal with that? Because you said it earlier, the food has been reduced from the 14 kg that you're getting initially. So therefore, people have additionally. So what do you suggest needs to be done?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. I think what is need to be done is there's more need for awareness. Maybe UNHCR should come down to negotiate with the OPM, at least to talk to OPM, and OPM should be able to put down the host community. OPM, the Office of the Prime Minister, should be able to bring together refugees and the host communities in a dialogue. And share with them, tell them what it is supposed to be, how it is supposed to be. I think that needs just more of awareness. You need to talk to the host communities in a polite way and make them understand the life of refugees, so that they can maybe render back the land for the refugees to continue access for themselves something.
I think what Malesh was saying really illustrated the kind of almost the time dimensions of a refugee crisis, the sort of the panic at the beginning in being fleeing your country, the initial welcome and reception and the need to sort of find safety and stability. And then that longer term in these protracted situations when, you know, you're living in a country for years, you start to put down in some way some roots there and are looking to provide for your family, get your kids in school, have access to training, and start to feed yourselves. So I think that's really interesting. And one of the things that UNHCR and WFP do together is really work very closely at all of those stages to meet refugee needs in transit, upon arrival, and over the medium to longer term. And that involves a very important policy dialogue in the countries to make sure that the boundaries are stretched in order to allow for more access to land, more freedom of movement, and UNHCR has done that so successfully in the Uganda context, and that just needs really to be sustained and pushed out. But also on the resourcing side, what Malesh was highlighting is that initially in the response there's often a sort of a an overpouring of support to ensure that the most immediate needs are met. But over time, those needs both change and we struggle to sustain them. I mean, both Uganda is one example for the South Sudanese refugees in Bidi Bidi, but in most of the of the countries where we work with UNHCR, over time, the support starts to wane, and it becomes very difficult to sustain very basic regular food assistance for refugees. And that results in ration cuts, or in either in terms of food or cuts in the amount of cash provided to refugees who are still not able to grow enough food to meet their own needs. So sustaining that support is important, but also ensuring the kind of support, enabling environment, but also resources that help ensure that refugees can get the seeds, the fertilizer, the technical training that they need in order to take advantage of technology to grow food, often on marginalized lands or in difficult places. This all becomes a really important part of sustaining that welcome support for refugees.
Pointed on what Valerie has said, and I mean the theme of World Refugee Day this year is the power of inclusion. And one of the things that we've noticed in a certain number in quite a few contexts is the fact that in a number of regions, you're talking about BDBD, we're talking about BDBD today, but many of the places that receive refugees, and Valerie made reference and Manish made reference to the fact that people are very much welcome at the beginning. What one has to know is that you're talking about the regions that are often very impoverished, and where if we were to do some investment in agriculture, in water systems, in people could actually produce more food. So what we're trying to say is let's try to include refugees in the environment where they are, and let's look at the needs of both host population and refugee population, and invest resources for the to improve the life of both at the same time. And then you can convince the host community that the generosity that they've shown should continue, and you can actually end up, as we've seen in a number of situations, when this kind of investments are made, with both population living much better than they were living before. Thank you.
Currently, humanitarian efforts and being these relief efforts is very different, as Valerie was saying, compared to the longer tail, long horizon investment, the and as you mentioned, Ralph, the investments in this infrastructure and systems. For currently how the WFP is configured or how the UNHCR is configured, is that feasible, or do you have to become more nimble in your approach to start to look at a contemporary modern world, and this is the way it is, and we're going to have more of these situations where we have displaced people, so we got to evolve the way that you're providing relief. So how is it currently instituted, and are you trying to use example or test cases to make yourself more nimble?
I'd say the way in which humanitarian needs are resourced is a broken system, because it's generated by appeals that are launched and then financed at best an annual cycle. And you know, with these protracted situations, with refugee situations lasting for years, programming and planning and financing on a sort of year-to-year basis is just not an effective way to meet needs. And it results in critical gaps, particularly as situations become more protracted. So that is an area that's in need of a fix to be fit for purpose for the 21st century. The food systems lens gives us a really good opportunity to look at how to address and better meet at least the food needs and promote food security for refugees. And in that context, we're looking at really changing the way that the world produces, consumes, and thinks about food. And our focus as the World Food Program is on food systems and fragile contexts and fragile food systems and broken food systems and sort of, you know, and refugees are at the sharp end of that stick. that they're very dependent on international aid to meet their daily food needs over years, puts them in the context of a broken food system, and finding ways to connect them to the local systems of producing food, of distributing food, of ensuring that they can consume and have access to a healthy diet, and doing that in a way that's not exclusive to the refugees, but is inclusive of the local environments, the fragile environments in which they're living and in which they're hosting, then is the goal. And we see the tremendous opportunity that investing in refugees can provide for the host community, and addressing the needs of those marginalized groups within the areas where refugees are residing has this win-win opportunity.
At our best, our food systems and our wealthiest environments, our food systems, our agricultural systems are fragile and often broken. And we're running against running at a headroom here on how to deal with things like planetary boundaries, a shrinking planet. And I like the way you describe this, being refugees being at the kind of the sharp end of this. And it is challenging. So how do we scope this out looking for what is the best scenario for then bringing forward these solutions? It sounds like you've got numerous different facets in these different settlements, in different locations where you can test out trial and error what can be successful for these new solutions to bring forward a future food systems, this more inclusive approach. How do you aggregate all of that and codify it into something that can be rolled out to other locations? And I'll turn that to Ralph or to Valerie, whoever feels that they want to tackle that one.
Yeah, no. Valerie said it. It's there is an opportunity. There's an opportunity in a number of contexts if we find the resources that are required. And while the humanitarian resources that we're getting are received on a yearly basis or for a 1 year period, there are some resources, development resources, which can be obtained through international financial institutions such as the World Bank or other bilateral development actors. And there are a number of locations, Rwanda, Mozambique, South Sudan, where we, with WFP and the FAO sometimes, we've looked at opportunities. What if we can find a resource and invest in a given area and help populations grow food in better conditions, link places where refugees are with the supply systems in a given region. So that can happen, and we are actually talking to a number of donors to, wherever possible, to shift from a model of distribution every month to a more long-term one, which, as we said earlier, actually helps the host. What Malish said earlier, the generosity that the host showed at the beginning of the crisis does not last. When it was still in the same situation after 10, 15, 20 years, then it becomes much more difficult to get this goodwill. And that goodwill is actually one of the things that is most important. We're talking about food, we're talking about water, we're talking about health, we're talking about a number of things. But for a refugee, to a certain extent also for an IDP, the most important thing initially, and I'm sure Malish will confirm, it's the fact that they are given that asylum, that there are people who receive them and say, we are going to welcome you until such time you can go back to your place of origin. So it's possible to invest, but we need to do that shift that Valerie made reference to earlier, and bringing development resources to find a solution, even if it's a temporary solution, to a displacement situation, and get that mindset that even if people are in exile, they still need to, as fast as possible, live normal lives until they can go back to their place of origin. And there are resources in many places. You can find the land available, and the host community are willing to provide the resources that are required for that, if we can bring additional development resources, which actually help their lives in the long run, the lives of hosts in the long run.
And what we're working together to do is really flesh this out in a, you know, in a set of countries, have like country specific investment cases that UNHCR, WFP, we develop together with other key partners like the World Bank, for instance, that really lay out the costs and benefits of providing traditional humanitarian assistance vis-a-vis approaches that create more sustainable opportunities for refugees' food security and for their inclusion on the socioeconomic side, and then use those as a basis to flesh out with more data and to identify and solidify key partnerships that are needed to take this take this forward. So very practically, we're looking to do that, but we're also leveraging the opportunity of the Food System Summit, the role that WFP is playing in terms of leading the component of the summit that focuses on resilience and fragility, but to see how we can connect our, you know, sustainable support for refugee self-reliance agenda with this global agenda, you know, very much championed by the Secretary General, who cares very much for refugees, as we all know, to really ensure that food systems can work for refugees. Because if they can work for refugees, then we are truly fulfilling our desire to ensure that they're working for those furthest behind.
I'm glad to be part of this today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it very much. Valerie or Ralph, yeah. Final thoughts?
Well, I would just add that, you know, everybody needs access to healthy and nutritious food, and refugees are such an essential part of those furthest behind, and we have the opportunity to build on top of, you know, great humanitarian assistance that reaches refugees, that enables them to meet their food needs today, but to incorporate refugees with those who are hosting them in solutions that ensure that food needs can be met over time. And effective food systems are a key part of that. And we're committed. We're committed to making that work for refugees and for all people.
Wonderful.
No, I think Malish and Valerie have said it all. One thought that I have as we're concluding is the fact that when a refugee leaves his or her home, especially in rural area, this is somebody who will not produce food, because this is somebody who will not have access to his or her farm, and will try and produce food in his or her country of asylum if land is available. So there is an opportunity, as we said earlier. It requires investment, requires mindset, requires policy, it requires a lot of things, but it's possible. So food, the title of this episode was Food Solution for the Foreseeable Dispute. There are opportunities, but we have to make the right investment and ensure that the good relationship between the host and the refugees that we are seeing in many contexts is maintained. But thanks a lot for this opportunity.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you all for so much for taking the time to partake in the conversation. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So I'll just say, until next time.